We're talking about Yale Law School, 1935, where you got in. Tell us a little bit about your coming to Yale, the situation in New Haven in 35 for you.
I was given a scholarship loan, not a gift, but a scholarship loan for my full tuition at the law school, and the amount for the full year was $450. The rest of my living expenses I was supposed to take care of some way. The law school had, or the university actually had, an employment office, so you apply there for employment, which I did. And during my first year, I worked first as a waiter in the Yale Commons, serving the restaurant side. The main commons served freshmen, but there was a smaller partition off room where graduate students mainly took their meals, and I worked there. And then I got a job working in the Yale Law Library. It was a National Youth Administration job. It was 20 hours a week. It paid 40 cents an hour. And the $8 that I earned that way exactly paid for my meals at the Yale Commons. So I was exactly where I started. Only in a different job. For my room, I was first assigned to the home of a Yale College professor, I think it was, to be sort of the janitor and man of all work around there. But then I left there and went to a rooming house where three of my classmates were living. So I went to the rooming house operated by an Irish lady by the name of Mrs. Dunn, and I paid $3 a week, I think, for my room. The matter of working was something I had to do all through law school. But I did change jobs from time to time, which we can get into if you want to.
Maybe let's go to the atmosphere at Yale Law School, the contrast, or what was your feel upon entering classes there and how you felt about the change?
Yale Law School was a real cultural shock for me with the background that I had up to that point. Growing up in a rural section of Kentucky and going to a small church college in Kentucky. In law school, the curriculum was a great change from what I went through in college. The method of teaching was very, very different. The so-called Socratic method was the prevailing one, and typically you were asked to recite the facts of a case, and then you were questioned about the holding in the case and so forth. And the first year class had two or three courses involving the entire class. Contracts was one of those. And that meant about 120 students, and we were seated in alphabetical order, and you'd be called on at random. You never knew when. And all of this was a drastic change from the very congenial, homey atmosphere of college, where you knew the professors quite well, and knew all your fellow students and and the whole thing was a lot simpler. I found that around me were just an awful lot of people who were a lot smarter than I was, and I had to struggle to keep up. The faculty members were really top in their profession, and the students, many of whom had gone to prep schools and colleges in the East, were way ahead of me in what they brought to the law school in the way of previous learning and experience.
Did you ever think that it would... That it was that it would be too overwhelming for you, just the combination of the culture shock and the training that the other people had and so on like that?
Well, I certainly thought it was a difficult time.
Excuse me, George. It's Dr. Alford.
Okay. How did you feel about being overwhelmed by the situation?
Well, I certainly felt that way. It never occurred to me to quit. And so I just commiserated with others who were in the same fix and plugged along and finally got to the point where I was reasonably comfortable with the situation. But the first semester was a very difficult time, as I recall.
Do you recall any of the faculty members who were of...
Well, perhaps the most notable one of our faculty, as far as reputation in the legal education circles is concerned, was Arthur Corbin. He was my contracts professor, and he at that time Samuel Wilderson, who was at Harvard, was a preeminent authority on contracts. So Willison's treatise on contracts was the contracts treatise. But Corbin was working on one, and after I finished law school, his treatise came out, and I think he became as well respected in the field as Willison. He was a very good teacher. One of the most gracious teachers that I had, in fact, the most gracious teachers, was a Southern gentleman, I think he came from Tennessee, by the name of Vance. And Mr. Vance taught property and insurance. And he always had some sort of a story or an anecdote to go along with a principle that he was trying to get across. He had a very soft way of speaking, very polite to students, and just a joy to be with. Some of the younger faculty members seemed to take a delight in embarrassing one, and I didn't appreciate them quite so much. The dean of the law school at that time was Charles Clark, and he later became the chief judge of the Second Circuit. In fact, I argued a case before him in 1950. Three, four, somewhere along in there. And I must say I didn't do any better before him as a judge than I did as a student in his procedure class.
Any students that you studied with that then went on and had illustrious careers themselves that you kept up with?
Well, I wouldn't say that we had... students who had careers where they became well known nationally. We had students who did very, very well in their legal careers. one of my fellow students was a professor at Columbia Law School who was very highly respected, Willis Reese. He was very highly respected there. We had tax lawyers in Washington, D.C., and we had a lawyer who started with Cravath and represented the Catherine Grimm interest in the Washington Post and Newsweek and so forth, things like that. We had one who was very much involved in the negotiation of the SALT treaty, Jerry Smith, the lawyer with the Catherine Grimm family was Fritz Beebe. Carl Price was a legislative counsel of the Treasury Department and later a tax lawyer there in Washington. They were prominent in the profession, but not notorious.
Not nationally. So. All right. Well, you finished in 1938, and we're still in the Depression in 38. We haven't entered into World War II. So what did you do as graduation was approaching?
Well, fortunately, I had a job. And the reason I had the job was that one of my classmates was Jack Turney, T-U-R-N-E-Y, Jack Turney, and his father had started a solo practice in Washington, D.C., in mid-career. He had come from St. Louis, where he was vice president and general counsel of the Cotton Belt Railroad, and he had set up an office in Washington, and by that time, the Motor Carrier Act of 1935 was passed and regulated trucks and buses for the first time, and some of the major companies came to Mr. Turney for representation. So it was an expanding field of law and provided an opportunity for a couple of youngsters out of law school, Jack and myself. That was fortunate because I didn't have the grades probably to make a Wall Street firm, and I wasn't interested in that anyway. I tried Kentucky, and there really were no opportunities at that time because of the Depression. So I didn't wind up with a job there. So I took the job in Washington, D.C. because it was available. I had worked there during the summers of 1936 and 1937, and had done research in transportation law for Mr. Turney. I liked the field, and it was just a very fortuitous circumstance. It's one of the many strokes of luck that I've had over my career.
Was he a solo practitioner?
Yes, he was. He had one associate working for him who left shortly after I arrived there.
So you and his son
mm-hmm.
then became with the dad a
yeah.
person firm.
Yes, that's right. And he for whatever reason decided we would form a partnership. So after a year and a half, the office became Turney, Reeves, and Turney.
T-R-T, Turney Reeves, Turney.
That's right.
Now, you must have now started to learn a lot about Interstate Commerce Commission.
Yes.
And previously, had their authority primarily been in the regulation of the rails, and now this was the motor vehicles would come under their authority?
Yes, that was the situation. The Interstate Commerce Commission was the first major independent regulatory commission in the federal government. It was established in 1887 and for the purpose of regulating the railroads and of correcting some abuses that had come about in the way the railroads ran their business. So it was primarily railroads until the Motor Carrier Act was passed in 1935. And then the whole new division, the Motor Carrier Division of the ICC, was created.
And so that your primary clients would be bus lines or moving lines that would want to come to you for what kind of help?
Yeah, well, the the major clients were, or as you suggested, the Greyhound lines in the bus area, Acme Transportation, Acme Fast Freight, it was called, in the freight forwarder field, which is also regulated by the ICC, several major truck lines, the Central States Motor Freight Bureau, which published tariff rates for all the motor carriers in the central part of the, of the country, and various others, truck lines and so forth. And the work was of initially of two kinds, both having to do with operating authority. You either were representing a client who was trying to establish the scope of its operations on the so-called grandfather date in which was June 1, 1935, because the law said that what you were doing on that date and have continued to do since is what you're entitled to continue to do as a matter of grandfather rights. And so they would be issued a certificate that would outline the territory that they were entitled to serve and the commodities that they were entitled to handle if it was a freight line, or the, just the points between which they operated, the routes over which they operated, if they were either a bus line or a truck line.
Now, just today in 2005, we don't think anything of limitations. For example, if you've got a bus line, of course it can go all over the country. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the way we think today. But in 1935, there was the sense that you only had a limited territory.
Oh, yes. Yes, and you could operate only within the area and between the points and over the routes specified in your certificate of public convenience and necessity.
And so part of your activity was to represent clients to actually figure out what they were doing.
So you had hearings at which you presented evidence of what the operations had been, and they would be contested sometimes and sometimes not, depending on the circumstances. The other kind of certificate that you got was the certificate based on public need. It was if you had not provided a service on June 1, but you wanted to provide one, then you would institute a proceeding or make an application to the ICC for authority to operate between points A and B and carry commodities so and so, maybe general commodities, specific commodities. And then if there were carriers already operating in that general area, or who would be affected by your service, they would come in and oppose you and say, there's no need for that service, it's duplicating, and so forth. So you either represented people who wanted to establish their grandfather rights or get new rights, or you were representing people who opposed companies that were trying to get these rights.
Now, I would suppose in a context like that, you've got the real development of antitrust law, possibly, don't you? Because wouldn't Greyhounds not want trailways or something
sure.
like that?
That's right. That is right. You had tried to establish, in effect, a monopoly, but it was an ICC-sanctioned monopoly, and it borders on the theory of public utilities as natural regulated monopolies. Now, the the trucks and bus lines were not the same regulated monopolies as a, say, an electric utility would be, for reasons that you probably don't want to go into. But
well, I would think it's the expense of setting up a system
sure.
and so on.
It just doesn't make sense to have.
Whereas trucks can go along the same highway,
right, that's right.
Regardless of the label.
That's right. And so there was always an argument about the need for competition, about the fact that the single line wasn't taking care of the public. That was one of the bones of contention, that you needed the competition, that competition would develop more business, and that the public wasn't being well served by the existing carrier.
Now, was the ICC's position generally pro-competition, or did they sort of analyze each application as it came and very fact-based? Or
as far as the grandfather rights were concerned, that was strictly fact-based. What you did was what you got. As far as the convenience and necessity applications were concerned, where you were trying to establish public need, they looked at each case on its own and would decide whether or not you had, if you were the applicant, have you established public need, and if so, for how much of the application that you provided for, or if they figured to inject another service would be disruptive, and so the public wouldn't be as well served, and were already being adequately served, then the application might be denied.
And you would represent primarily companies that would want to keep monopoly power. Then,
yeah, most of them, certainly the on the bus side, that was true, because Greyhound was the early dominant carrier in the unregulated era, their main competitor was a group of local companies who had affiliated under the name of Trailways. So Trailways and Greyhound were the competitors. And Greyhound was always battling to keep Trailways out, or maybe vice versa in some cases. But for the most part, Greyhound was already there. They had most of the routes. So yes, we were generally on the side of the established carrier, trying to limit the competition.
Now, in terms of speaking of competition, was there much competition in the legal profession at that time doing what you were doing, or did, in a sense, you folks have a corner on this new statute that was?
Well, there developed a motor carrier bar. In other words, there were lawyers in Washington who gravitated to the new motor carrier field. There were lawyers there who, like Mr. Turney, had been handling transportation cases for many, many years, primarily in the railroad field. Some of them also went into the motor carrier field. Then around the country, there would be general practitioners who were asked by a local trucking company to represent them, and he'd have to start in the end and learn the field. But they would spring up here. I can remember lawyers who were located in, say, in Memphis, Tennessee, or in Jacksonville, Florida, who had been probably general practitioners, but got into the field because they had clients there who were being regulated and needed representation. And as you went into the field, just like me coming from law school, I knew nothing much about it. You learn as you go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, you ended up doing some representation before the ICC. You had mentioned before when we were talking a shared expense travel case.
Well, yes. That was a case that came along in 1940. And it involved an exemption in the Interstate Commerce, in the Motor Carrier Act, which applied to occasional, casual, and reciprocal transportation. And that was intended to cover what had developed during the Depression as a means of people taking automobile trips when they really needed some financial help to do it. and so that they would advertise for passengers to go along the same route that they were going to share the expense. So there became a practice of share expense travel. And this exemption was carved out because it wasn't intended that they should be regulated, although technically they were moving interstate commerce, carrying people, and getting paid for it in the way of shared expense.
But because of the historical exception of or the Depression, where mm-hmm. people had been doing this.
Yeah, and it made no sense to regulate it anyway. But as you know, people can ruin any good thing, so there arose a sort of a small industry composed of share expense travel bureaus who would operate in major cities, and they would serve as clearinghouses for people who wanted to travel cheaper than by bus, and for the drivers who were driving in the share expense field. And the drivers became not just casual, occasional and reciprocal operators, but regular operators.
So you had direct competition on your hands.
That's right.
And that you didn't want.
So the bus companies found they actually were eating into their business. And so they decided that they should invoke the power given to the Interstate Commerce Commission to remove this exemption if they found it necessary to do so in the public interest. So a proceeding was instituted in 1940 to determine whether this exemption should be removed.
So that it was within the statute itself was the authorization
yes.
of the ICC to remove it?
Yes, it was.
Okay.
Yes, it was. And the our client was the National Bus Traffic Association, which was an association in which all of the bus companies joined, with headquarters in Chicago. And I represented the National Bus Traffic Association in this proceeding, where the issue was, should this exemption be removed?
And you were all of 25 years old.
I was 25. And we had hearings in 8 cities from coast to coast, starting in Oklahoma City, and then Dallas, and then Los Angeles, and San Francisco, and Seattle, and Denver, and Chicago, and New York.
Mm, it was all 8 wonderful.
Yeah, it was a wonderful time for an unattached single man
to see the country.
Did
you take Greyhound?
No. We took the Pullman, took the train, and we traveled from coast, as I say, from coast to coast. It took about a month in the process, maybe a little more. And I'd never been west of the Mississippi River, so it was a great experience. At each place, we had a local lawyer for the local bus line there, and they would help in organizing the witnesses, and then they might present them, or I might present them. That was the way we proceeded.
What was the nature of the testimony?
The testimony was that these people had paid a fare through the share expense travel bureau. They paid a fare to them, and then they had been given a ride to the agreed destination, say from San Francisco to Chicago, by such and such a driver. And we were establishing a couple of things. That one, the bureau participated in the